Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is the final straw on I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF out of Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can contact us for ideas and criticisms and whatever else at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. This week's episode features a workshop by Mel Basil, an indigenous Gitxan and Wet'suwet'en organizer, sovereigntist, and anarchist of the Unist'ot'en Action Camp. For folks in the listening audience, Unist'ot'en is located on unceded native lands in so-called British Columbia, Canada. More about the Unist'ot'en Action Camp can be found at unistotencamp.com. This audio is from an almost hour and a half long presentation that Mel gave on Saturday, the 24th of May, at the Montreal Anarchist Book Fair, entitled Anarchy, Indigenous Sovereignty, and Decolonization. Many thanks to CKUT Radio in Montreal for sharing this content with The Final Straw. More info on CKUT can be found at www.ckut.ca. This week, we'll be presenting the first of two parts of Mel's presentation. The second will be aired in coming weeks and linked together on the Final Straw website soon. First, an announcement about the health of long-term political prisoner Kevin Rashid Johnson. The following text was found at Rashid Mod, that's rashidmod.com, where one can seek further updates on the situation. Medical neglect. Kevin Rashid Johnson experienced a frightening medical crisis beginning on May 14th. We just got word of it a few days ago. He had crippling pain behind his left eye, blurred vision, and very high blood pressure. This case of severe hypertension, if untreated, could cause life-threatening medical episodes. Today, Rashid told us, quote, "Medical neglect is a serious problem here. I personally have witnessed two inmates die from neglect. On the night of May 14th, nurses Doak and Armstrong referred me to see a doctor on May 15th. I have never seen a doctor." Unquote. During his health emergency, Rashid was denied a scheduled legal visit. On May 19th, Noel Hanrahan, PI, and mitigation specialist Cynthia Scow were scheduled to fly to Texas, and their visit was prevented by the Clements Unit and the ignominiously named Texas Office of Access to Counsel. Rashid's legal team will reschedule this trip ASAP and is fighting this illegal and inappropriate action by the TDCJ. The state of Virginia, he is being held in Texas on an interstate compact transfer, has tried tactic after tactic to isolate and prevent Rashid from communicating. They transferred Rashid out of state in 2012. He has had only two phone calls while in Texas for the past year, and four visits in the 2 years since his transfer from Virginia. In Texas, he can only purchase 40 stamps a month. If he is broke, he gets 10 stamps as an indigent prisoner. Turn the white-hot spotlight on the Clements Solidarity Confinement Punishment Unit at the TDCJ. We are standing with Rashid. 1. Please call and tell the warden at the TDCJ Clements, that's C-L-E-M-E-N-T-S unit, that health care is a human right. Demand that Rashid see a doctor. TDCJ Clements, 9601 Spur 591, Amarillo, Texas. That's A-M-A-R-I-L-L-O, Texas. 79107-9606. And the number is 806-381-7080. Again, that's 806-381-7080. 2. Call and write a personal note to the Ombudsman, P.O. Box 99, Huntsville, Texas, 77342-0099. TDCJ Health Services Division Office of Professional Standards can be reached at 936 936-437-4271. Again, that's 936-437-4271. They could be faxed at 936-437-4930. Again, fax is 936-437-4930. Or emailed at ombudsman@tdcj.state.tx.us. 3. Call and write Inspector General's office. Again, another phone number, 512-671-2490. That is 512-671-2490. They can be written at 11101 Metric Boulevard, Building I, Austin, Texas, 78758. 4. Write Rashid today. Send your Rashid postcard. If you don't have a stack of them for your friends, order them from us, meaning RashidMod.com. Ask RashidMod.com to send you a dozen by snail mail. Use them to have your friends write Rashid. Let him know that he is not alone. Here's Rashid's contact. Kevin Johnson, number 185-9887, Clements Unit, 9601 Spur 591, Amarillo, depending on where you're from, Texas, 79107. Finally, 5. Put money in Rashid's inmate trust account. Here's a piece by Jennifer Black called Who is Kevin Rashid Johnson? Kevin Rashid Johnson is a remarkable artist, accomplished writer, and politicized theoretician. Please listen to his work, read his articles, and view his inspiring art. Rashid Johnson went to jail as a young adult in 1990 and has spent the last 24 years living in jail and prison cells, mostly relegated to isolation in solitary confinement, buffeted by the system, enduring forced relocations, harassment, brutality, and living conditions so squalid they qualify as a human rights abuse. A mobilizer, Rashid has spent his years in prison agitating against draconian conditions and organizing his fellow prisoners to unify for the purpose of holding prison officials accountable to the standards of the law. Like so many prisoners before him, writing from, quote, the belly of the beast, unquote, Rashid contributes to the proud tradition of radical prison thought. He has not shirked from exposing gross prison injustice and abuse of power, even though in doing so he has made himself a target of brutality. Guards have repeatedly beat him, in one instance dislocating his shoulder, denied legal proceedings, forced him to endure long stretches of isolation, deprived him of meals, purposefully prevented him access to mail and other personal items, forced him to witness brutal spectacles of violence, and denied him medical care. His response? To continue his work. Quote, "What they fail to grasp is that we march to the tempo of a different drum than the one that they beat. The people's beat, a beat that never stops, because it is this very rhythm of life, love, community, and in times of struggle, reaches a staccato pitch, livens the masses to rise up and shatter the forces that bind them." Unquote. Despite his isolation, he manages to donate art and articles to prison radio and to the new African Black Panther Party, building bridges where previously only walls existed. The people at RashidMod.com urge you to read his words, look at his art, and listen to his recordings, because in doing so you are raising his profile, and that helps protect him from the most violent forms of retribution.
This is Disembodied Voice reading a statement for the Never Alone art exhibit by Sean Swain. I used to be a big fan of writer Daniel Quinn. For anyone unfamiliar, Quinn wrote Ishmael, My Ishmael, and Beyond Civilization, among other works. What I appreciated was that, through reasoned analysis, he led his readers to see that tribal living was not inferior to what we have now, and in fact was probably superior. The logical conclusion from reading Quinn would be that this way of life, what I call swivelization, with its mass production and its concurrent mass destruction, needs to go. I'm sure that such a general statement, that swivelization needs to go, would be acceptable to Marie Mason and to Eric McDavid. What I mean is, it would seem that such a statement would be a point of agreement for Marie Mason, Eric McDavid, and Daniel Quinn. Yet, as I understand it, when Quinn was asked to make a statement in support of Marie Mason, he not only refused, but got somewhat irate and asserted that people like Marie, engaging in radical acts against the larger system, are part of the problem. Now, to be clear, I didn't hear Quinn say that myself, but a good friend that I trust affirmed that Quinn said that, and I have since lost respect for Quinn as a result. But whether he said it or not, those sentiments are often taken as a self-evident truism, even among activists and radicals, and some self-proclaimed anarchists. It's a popular position that holds that militant attacks on a system, however unjust or tyrannical that system is, or however much that system deserves to be attacked, only provoke more repression and tighter controls. Such a position was articulated by an Occupy Cleveland spokesperson who distanced the movement from the actions of the Cleveland Four, claiming that such acts of violence lead to the government taking away our rights. I would say just the opposite is true. I'm one of the select few who have the luxury of saying exactly what I think in the United States because I'm expressing myself from a Supermax facility. So let me put this out there. The real problem is that we have too few Marie Masons and Eric McDavids. That's just a simple mathematical fact. If you have a situation where only one person deviates from the norm, the enforcers can devote all of their resources to catching that single offender, and the odds of that offender getting caught greatly increase. That holds true for robbing a bank or tipping over a cop car or burning down a university that has it coming. But if you have 50 people doing it, that divides the enemy enforcers' resources and increases the odds that the bank robbers or cop car tippers or university burners will get away with it. And of course, with enough success and enough people joining in, the activity ceases to be a deviation from the norm, and it becomes the norm. Marie Mason and Eric McDavid got locked up for being too rare. If there were 50 Marie Masons and 50 Eric McDavids, I suspect the enemy system could never keep any of them locked up for any considerable period of time. If there were 1,000, we'd all be living in yurts by now and hunting the buffalo, and the Hoover Dam would be a distant memory. But there isn't 1,000, and that's the problem. When Marie and Eric get locked up, and there isn't any immediate rash of actions, just as big or bigger, we give them permission to go after Jeremy Hammond and to entice the Cleveland Four. We embolden repression with inaction. We need more and more Marie Masons and Eric McDavids, not fewer. And I want to be clear here so there's no mistake. I don't want anyone thinking that I might be advocating criminal behavior. I want you to know unequivocally that I am most assuredly advocating criminal behavior. If you are not currently engaged in actions that would result in prison time, or you are not planning such actions, I'm hoping this statement shames you into doing something useful with your life. If what you're up to isn't illegal, it's probably not worth doing. In support of my point, when Henry David Thoreau was jailed for refusing to pay his taxes, Henry's friend Ralph Waldo Emerson went to visit him and with a rueful smile asked, "Henry, what are you doing in there?" To which Henry David Thoreau responded with seriousness, "No, Ralph, the question is, what are you doing out there?" In the unjust world we inhabit, the only place for a just person is prison. Thoreau is a role model. Emerson is a collaborator. For anyone still under the illusion that you are free and the risks associated with resisting are too great, I remind you that your world is a concentration camp and you're currently being marched into the gas chamber of our collective future. The only reasonable hope of survival lies in breaking ranks. So having bewildered or pissed off the majority of you, I'd like to move on to the question of why Marie and Eric are still locked up. I realize this forum is designated to raise funds to help out the two of them, providing commissary and creature comforts, but I have to ask some theoretical questions here. Does anybody know where Marie or Eric are being held? Do you know if the prisons have gun towers? When are the shift changes? Can you troll the staff parking lot with a cell phone camera and capture faces and plates? How feasible is it to follow staff home? What are their security levels? A few more questions. Let me just throw this out there, since I'm at a Supermax facility and I can say things other people can only think about silently. Are there helicopters piloting simulators online? What do helicopter tours cost? Are there metal detectors at places like that? Are there areas to land and conceal a helicopter close to the prisons? I know, some extra snacks and envelopes would be great. I get it. But a few decades ago, two women and one man broke Assata Shakur out of a federal detention facility. I know with advances in security, technology, particularly in surveillance, such actions are more difficult than they used to be. But trust me, with 23 years of experience, I can tell you, except for possibly supermax facilities, prison fascists have virtually no contingency for preventing outside supporters from liberating a prisoner. They count on deterring the actions with the threat of huge penalties, and they count on rounding everyone back up later, period. It seems to me that the lack of even contemplating a liberation action speaks to the degree that everyone overestimates the power of the enemy. It's bewildering to me that Mumia Abu-Jamal, to take one example, has millions of supporters, tens of thousands of dollars in funding through various revenue streams, and he has access to a prison yard on a daily basis, but nobody has yet to simply get him out. Why? See, that's the dynamic that needs to be defeated. Few of us act because prison time is a deterrent, and those few who do act then get caught and face that time. But if those who get caught were liberated, more would act, and fewer would get caught, and the larger system would destabilize faster. Liberated resistors would return to the struggle and return the favor. And in the meantime, those who are on the inside temporarily can attack the system from within, as the Army of the 12 Monkeys recently proved at a few different Ohio prisons. You can access their literature from a link at seanswain.org. Plunging prisoners into disorder certainly wouldn't hurt the larger cause. Raising funds for Maria and Eric for their legal project and their relative comfort is a noble thing. I don't in any way want to discourage that. What you're doing now makes a difference in their lives. But our world is a concentration camp. This can end in only two ways, and one of them sucks. In the other, we have to stop spending time admiring Marie and Eric, and we have to start acting like them. This is Disembodied Voice, reading a script from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Ohio's Supermax facility. If you can't hear the sound of Sean's voice, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain, number 243-205, OSP, 878 Coitsville-Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio, 44505. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org.
This workshop is titled Anarchy, Indigenous Sovereignty, and Decolonization. It's presented by Mel Bazil, Indigenous Kitskan, Wet'suwet'en, family man, sovereignist, and anarchist, and participant in the Inner Stockton camp. So just on behalf of the Montreal Book Fair, we really want to welcome Mel to Montreal and to the Anarchist Book Fair. Welcome, Mel. Turn over to you.
Nobles, children of nobles, women nobles, I thank you for being here. I'm here to spread the word of not just Unistoten Camp itself, but the model that we've produced. We would like to encourage other communities to participate in resistance building in a sense that we really change how we do things. And I guess to introduce the whole topic, we spoke of an indigeneity and anarchy as a really strong combined force that we could all look forward to. And why would that fit so well? And I guess I could start with myself. Why it fits with me so well is I did grow up as an Indigenous person, as a child that did not see a nation state as an authority figure. And I did not see church and state as a fear-based system that I needed to comply to. When I was a child, I don't know if you still have to do this in school. I don't think you do. We were expected to stand up and pledge allegiance to a flag that was not of our design. And we had to pledge allegiance to a queen who had nothing, no knowledge of who we were. And so how I grew up was challenging everything that came at me from school because I saw it as a source of control. And I didn't feel the same kinds of controls when my own people were teaching me something. And I had a comparison. My grandmother is like a professor. If you go to a university and all the knowledge they carry, they have to go through a lot of books to get that knowledge. My grandmother had that knowledge from experience. and she witnessed the Great Depression. She witnessed all the world wars. She witnessed the changes in the environment because of environmental disasters from industry. And she told me about how the changes in the weather were coming. She taught me about climate change before climate scientists had it in their repertoire. So Western knowledge was something that I was always challenging. It wasn't something that I was always doubting. I would just question everything I learned in school, especially because of the controls, the power of controls that came along with it. It wasn't a comfortable setting, sitting in a classroom. If we misbehaved, we had to sit on our hands, that kind of stuff. And I had it good, considering what my parents went through, my grandparents went through in residential schools. So if you haven't heard of residential schools before, it's because it's not taught in schools. It's not taught in Western knowledge. It's only been a thing of study since the mid-90s, when they were starting to shut down. In 1996, the last one that I know of shut down. So it was about 100 years of oppression of children. And that didn't stop. That carried on into foster care. In fact, in 2011, across this nation, the number of children who are from Indigenous families that were in care, it passed the number of children who went to residential school in all of residential school history. So that's the situation our people are in. And you've also heard of the history behind the murdered and missing women in Canada. And in 2011, I also read an article written by the Human Rights Watch. And the Human Rights Watch put out an article called Those Who Take Us Away. And it was written from accounts of Aboriginal and Indigenous women who were violated by RCMP officers since the 1940s. And that involves violence, threats of violence, sexual violence, threats of sexual violence, and death threats. And we see when we protest at sites of at point of extraction or point of assumption, when there's protests, the police are there to stop us. But they're not doing anything to find out what's going on with the murdered and missing women. And so we see their priorities. We see this nation state's priorities. It is not a healthy priority for Indigenous peoples. So on the onset of building up this style of camp, we realized we cannot operate within an institution. We cannot operate from boardroom table, and we cannot operate based on fighting for rights, because we contend with that term rights, that they don't exist. And we thought about it. It was rooted in our language. I asked one of our elders in our community, how do you say the word responsibilities? Because I was thinking, I don't want to use rights when we make our arguments. And that elder told me, enough do it then. It's the same word we have for our laws. So our responsibilities translates also to our laws. And I thought about that, and I was like, yeah, my grandmother showed me our responsibilities. So she was showing us living laws. And then I translated that even further and thought, well, the United Nations is attempting to push their form of rights on Indigenous peoples around the world. And nation states are signing on to this declaration. And that declaration is in the form of rights. So it says that the top-down structure has the authority to hand us down the form of rights that they choose to give us. And that's not our way of living from the ground up. We show each other our responsibilities, which is just our way of life. Our way of life, how we fish, how we walk the trail, how we ask the animal permission to take its life. All of these things are our responsibilities, and it's shown to us. There's no central form of power that tells us how to power with nature. And that's what we see in nation states. It's a central form of power telling everybody how to power over each other and fit into the hierarchy somewhere. And although we do have traditional hierarchies in our traditional systems, they are not a power over structure. That is a power with structure. Because we power with everything around us, it is not a control mechanism. There's no room to fit in any control mechanisms into our way of life. So it was exciting to produce this model of a resistance movement, which was not based on rights. We were not fighting for our rights. We realized what we're doing is we are asserting our responsibilities. And we need healthy spaces for that. We need healthy water, healthy land, and healthy populations. So if we all endeavor to become good ancestors to our lands, then that is what we need in our path. We need that river that flows past the camp. Her name is Witsinkwa. We can fill our hands up and drink straight from it. Many of you have been to this camp and drank this water, and it's haunting. At night, in your dreams, you're just dreaming about this river. It is very beautiful. There's not very many rivers in this world like this left. And it happens to be a proposed corridor for seven companies to build pipelines for hydraulic fractured natural gas and tar sands bitumen and condensate. So our lands are already hit by cumulative impacts. So you've heard of cumulative impacts? It all accumulates, right? It builds up over time because corporations and industry do not clean up their mess. Forestry attempts to, but they really mispractice forestry in nation states. This is why we see the explosion of the population of the pine beetle in the so-called BC. So in the Western Hemisphere, we never seen in any history a sea of red. And the reason for that is because when we take a piece of wood from a tree, I'm going to stand up for a bit.
Is it here?
Have you heard of bentwood boxes? They're not just a piece of art. We had thousands of those before. And it was made for storing foods, greases, berries, tools. And you could bury them in the ground and you could stay. They could stay there for years or months. And you could pull it out and it's still fresh. Not fresh, but... It wouldn't rot. And these are made out of cedar. But we didn't cut down a forest of cedars for thousands of bentwood boxes. Over time, if you wanted to go make a bentwood box, you would go to your territory and take only enough wood out of the tree and leave the rest standing. And it would heal, but you asked it permission. That is free prior informed consent. You're asking the tree permission to be there, to take a piece of it, so you could make something out of it. And then you would steam bend it into a box and sew it together and put a, we would knock over a stump and take the black pitch from underneath it and seal the bottom. The bottom base would then be airtight and watertight. You could boil hot water in there by throwing hot rocks inside it and make a soup. Well, we made thousands of these and that was how we did it. We didn't cut down a forest to do this. And every little thing we did, we asked it permission first. Medicines, animals, plants, medicines, and when we went hunting, we waited for a giveaway. The animal would give itself to us, and we would honor its life by taking it. And we would treat it with ceremony and make use of every part of that animal. So Western society doesn't see that. We don't hear stories about what we buy for foods. We don't have a conversation with people who had their hands in the work. And that was what our lifestyle was like. It was a very localized trade network. And the free prior informed consent protocol that we had designed is not a new process. It wasn't based on the United Nations Declaration. It was based on historical stories. And it was based on knowing that that was built for trade relations with our neighboring nations. That you would also share ideas, just much like I'm doing right now. And it was our way to protect our ideologies. Because we had an integral system already in our heads and in our hearts. and we couldn't just change our minds about anything willy-nilly. We had to slowly digest things because making decisions affected our next generations. And so what we had to do was, in the buildup of this resistance movement, was go back to the old ways. We didn't have to find new ways. We had to go back to our oldest ways possible. And that kept us off of boardroom tables. That kept us out of building an institution out of the whole thing. And it also kept us away from NGOs, non-governmental organizations, who are mostly sponsored by foundations that takes monies from the very industries we're fighting. And that is why NGOs will never win a campaign. They will always get only so close and yet so far. And this is because their monies are they're sustainable if they only get so close. So we couldn't depend on somebody to come to us and help us. We didn't think of it that way. And what got us there was one day we drove our vehicle into the ditch and we were like stuck. Right out in the middle of nowhere. And we realized, you know what? We're not going to go to the road and look for somebody to help us. Nobody's going to stop. Nobody's going to come out here. We got to dig this out ourselves. And I thought about that while we were digging this vehicle out. And we did get out, but it made me realize nobody's going to come and help us build this camp. Nobody's going to help us design it. Nobody's going to help us win. We got to win this. So we went fully responsibilities-based. So we've called it a responsibilities-based intervention, as opposed to a rights-based intervention. We are no longer in the confines of institution or colonial frameworks. We don't have to play Canada's game. We don't have to play BC's game or England's game. We don't have to play all of these things. And we don't see police as authority. We don't see military as an authority. They're a huge hindrance. And we decided to build up this exciting framework to also bring back our way of life, but also to honor that we have guests in our lands now. We have people who have settled, and settled based on breached agreements from the nation state and our people. So our people and this nation state have agreements that were breached. And this nation state breached many agreements that were in forms of treaty. Some people have explained to me that when they signed treaties with the colonies, they did not intend that treaty to be used to build a nation state. Meaning it affects, their treaty affects us way over here in the West Coast. But over on the East Coast, they never intended to sign treaties with a local community to spread that local community right across the whole land. They never intended that. So the interpretation of treaties is what's also called the spirit of treaties. And the spirit of treaties is being ignored by the nation state. We saw that with the bills being passed recently, with the omnibus bill, to diminish rights. And we saw that coming about 20 years ago, because I was at a child welfare conference, and my buddy and I, Tagastai, we had a discussion and we thought about it, and I said, you know what, we think we're in trouble now because of how many children were going into care and how many women were going missing and how much of the lands was disappearing from overforesting and overmining and agricultural expansion. So the cumulative impacts were building up more back then. And we thought about it, we said, we're in trouble now. Wait till something bigger is coming at us. What is that going to be? We didn't know, but we were preparing. We got into different skill sets. We got into things that we didn't think we would need now, but we took on skills. We drew it in. And then in around the mid-2000s, we heard about proposals from all of these pipelines. And people started discerning, why is the pipeline no longer 6 inches? Why is it 38 inches? Why is it bi-directional? What is it transporting? And we learned about the tar sands and hydraulic fracturing and how high in carbon these unconventional sources of fossil fuels are, as well as their dangers. And so we thought in the buildup of this resistance, the best steps are also to build nothing but solidarity. It was never going to be about us winning, just us. So we had to seek out allies based on responsibilities
and grassroots organizing to avoid NGOs and governments and boardroom tables and controls. So that's the exciting piece to what we began to create. And why that was so important at that time was because nobody else was doing anything like this. Few and far between, we hear about people on this planet stepping completely away from nation-state frameworks. And instead of appealing for rights, we began to assert the very responsibilities that we were all born with. And that was the exciting piece to it. I guess to continue on with the image of indigeneity, I would like to put it out there that every one of us in this room comes from an origin far, far back that resembles an indigenous way of life. Before writing systems and capitalism and empire building, every one of us in this room has ancestors farther back that had mothers and grandmothers teaching you how to pick medicines, how to live humbly on the earth and live within our means. It wasn't until colonization occurred in history with empire buildings, Byzantine Empire, the Roman Empire, creating nation states, which also created forms of control. So that's why we saw soldiers being paid with salt, because salt was the extractive. The extractive was a mineral, salt. It could heal wounds, it could make your food taste good, it could preserve foods. So it really changed how far you could travel and how far you could go and trade, but also how far you could go to make war. Because if you brought your own food with you and it was salted, then you could go further off for empire building. So that was the root word of soldier, was salt. That was how you were paid. You were paid with a sack of salt. So that was, you heard of the term, he's not worth his salt? Well, he wasn't worth his pay. And that was for extending your boundaries and extending your borders in creating nation states. And it was against all of our nature to be formed into a homogeneous system. Because if you were tribal in your origins, and that was shamed out of you in order to become a nation state, no longer could you become, to just uphold an original Germanic tribe or Breton tribe that was unique and distinct from each other. They got lumped into one nation state over time. And that was how things were left. And instead of upholding something that's kind of easy to uphold, your distinctness, now you had to uphold something homogeneous. And if you could imagine if that was expected of us, to no longer be distinct, but just to be the same as every other indigenous person across Turtle Island. We're not the same. Our lands are not the same. The waters that we drink and harvest from are not the same. I don't know how to clean a walleye. I don't know how to preserve a walleye. I could never imagine attempting to teach responsibilities when I'm making mistakes with trying to preserve this food that I don't know about. So that's the distinctness I'm talking about, your relationship to the land that you see as territory. It's not yours. Tribes had relationships with the land base that they seen as recognition. It was recognizable to your spirit and to who you are living in that space. That earth message to you, you message back to it. All indigenous tribes around the world knew how to give back. You give back to the earth if you're taking. You knew how to live within your means. You knew not to destroy your surroundings to have an abundance. All human beings had that ability, but empire building, when it occurred, changed things. All of a sudden, the market appeared, and that market could become corrupted. That market could be corrupted, so governments came in to control the market. And I don't know when the first CEO came along, but that should have been dealt with a long time ago. Why I'm bringing up indigeneity and anarchy as a perfect fit is because of when we see colonial discourse in history and how it affected populations around the world. My grandmother saw the human population just balloon in her lifetime. And she said, that's because of oil and gas. Oil and gas is allowing that to happen. It gets us further and further than salt ever could have. Refrigeration and oil and gas brings all of this systems into a globalization that has belittled all earlier forms of capitalism, which could have stayed kind of healthy. The market could have been a healthy system for a long, long time, but free enterprise got greedy, and globalization and free enterprise, pretty much everybody's a CEO now, and everybody's in it for themselves. And it became a system where now capitalism, we can define it as, I want it all and I want it now. It's in a hurry. Billionaires are not mad if they are leveling off. They're mad because they're not making billions faster than they did yesterday. That's what they're angry about. That's why they're getting these armies and police to control us. So indigeneity and anarchy has a perfect fit because we're all on the path of decolonization. We all deny colonial state. And I'm using the term indigenous because have you heard of the three words used to describe our people? Aboriginal, First Nations, the earlier one is Indian, indigenous. And then the distinct names of the very people, Gaksan, Wet'suwet'en, Anishinaabeg. So we have distinct names, yes, but to speak to the collective of indigenous nations, I prefer the term indigenous because it means that we are from here. The root word of Aboriginal actually means once was original. So we're no longer. Well, you can call Sean Atleo and others like that. You can call them Aboriginal, go ahead. But indigenous peoples who live close to the earth and still live their way of life. We're not once was original. We are original. And First Nations implies that we came here first over some ice bridge that is 100 meters up in the air, probably minus 100 degrees Celsius. So it's kind of unlikely that we came across on an ice bridge with the mammoths. We really believe in our creation too. So indigeneity has a spirituality, and yes, a traditional hierarchy. But I was posed a question at my talk on Thursday night at the Friendship Center downtown when CCUT brought me to speak to the public about First Nations resistance against, or Indigenous resistance against extractions. So I'm not talking about dental extractions, I'm talking about minerals, oil and gas, maybe some dental extractions, sure. We spoke of anarchy communities supporting our movement at the earlier stages. And it was very exciting because, as I mentioned, since kindergarten I denied colonial state. I didn't know until I was in grade 5 that when we were studying ideologies of the world, we looked at communism, socialism, democracy, republics. And then I got into anarchy and I loved the symbols, I loved the write-up about being the antithesis to hierarchies. And I read all this information and this is me! And I was really excited to find out what ideology I was going to follow. But what wasn't in there was indigenous sovereignty. So because we were living sovereignty, it wasn't defined. It wasn't something I was looking for. But anarchy was the closest concept that fit what I was feeling. So I did self-identify in grade 5 that I'm an anarchist. And it wasn't until later, moving to cities and meeting more anarchists, I realized I'm so comfortable around anarchy. And growing up, feeling safe around anarchy, but my older generations don't understand it. They think because the media just portrays the smashing of the windows that that's all they see. And they don't see the sweetness because we're not bitter. We're quite comfortable with supporting each other. The mutual aid keeps us sweet. The capitalists are the ones that are bitter. They're the ones I feel uneasy around. The ones that are looking to expand and push me out of the way and keep me out of the way. Those were the ones I was bitter at. Anarchists always made me feel welcome, comfortable, and my son feels the same way. We went to an anarchist garage sale. It wasn't called an anarchist garage sale. It was just, and it was just a bunch of anarchists. We knew them, and we came to their garage sale, and just like I thought my son and my daughter would be comfortable around everybody I knew, and just exactly the way I thought it would play out. He was just drawn to everybody. He's shaking their hands. He's playing with their toys, and they're playing with him. So I had a bit of freedom to talk with people, and it was really great. But as I mentioned, anarchy movements and sovereignty movements are on the path of decolonization. I don't know if you've been told that before, that that's the path you're following. Denying colonial state is decolonization. But we ask to go further, to look at what kind of point of origin that you might have come from. And we spoke of this in the Victoria Anarchist Book Fair, in a presentation I gave last year about how we can feel connected to our place of origin. And many people just said, well, I take my shoes off and I stand on the earth and I'm just connected to where I'm at. I love that. I get homesick and I put myself into a dream state and I go home. I can connect with my place of origin because it's familiar to me. And we're so connected to our place of origin, we don't really tend to try to do it. So, are you guys getting a little bit uncomfortable? Let's do a quick exercise. This is what grounds me when I want to go home and I'm far away. So if we can stand up. Isn't that religious? It's not religious or anything, so don't worry about it. If you are spiritual, you can connect to where you go, where your origins are. So the first step is take your hands together in front of your belly. Breathe really deep. If you're in Tai Chi, breathe down to your belly. And rub your hands together really brisk, really fast, like you're trying to start a fire. Break out of jail, start a fire. Think about your place of origin. The water, the animals that are from there, the plants. You should feel fire in your hands right now. Now separate your hands, but keep rubbing them like you're rubbing them together. Breathe and out. Nice. Now right in front of your heart, hold it like it's a ball. Don't touch your fingers together. You should feel it push away from itself. You feel it building. It is your life force. And your life force comes from your place of origin, not here. So you can attempt to do this from a beach or on the grass, and think about where your ancestors come from. I did this when I was in university and I was homesick, and I could picture the river, I could smell it. What felt like a few minutes was actually quite a few hours, and my mother told me I actually did go home. And I could feel the cold water running over my hand. That was what I was visualizing. So you can go home wherever you're from. It is possible. And you can clear yourself, draw in some energy. How does that feel? You got a little bit of a jolt? Okay. Yeah, please take your seats and finish. Carry on. When I first did this, I was reading up about water. I was reading about what was called water rights. And I was looking at all these terms and I wasn't agreeing with any of it. And I closed the book, I slammed it shut. And I thought about it because I traveled home to the river where we come from. As a child, that was where my mother brought us to fish. And it was really a beautiful thing that happened, studying water rights. And just slamming it shut and actually going home for a bit. And then when I woke up, it was dark outside, and I was kind of shocked and I was really hot right here. There was like kind of a bead of sweat coming out. And so it was really exciting. At the same time, I was a little bit shocked that that happened, but I could smell the river when I had my eyes closed and I was in dream state. And when I shut this book, I was really angry, and I sat there thinking, we don't have a right to water. We have a relationship to water. So now that we're protecting this river as a collective of people, and we have wonderful anarchist communities supporting, grassroots communities supporting through fundraisers and mutual aid and solidarity, and migrant movements helping us learn more about what's going on in the rest of the world, we realized we're not protecting our right to clean water. There's no such thing. We are protecting our responsibility to the relationship we have with the clean water that is already existing. We have a relationship with that water. We don't own it. We can't say our river, our coast. It's our relationship to it. That's what we own, is our relationship. That means how responsibly we approach the river. We don't decide to transform the river to fit our needs. And so the relationship we have with animals, plants, the earth, and the waters is tribal knowledge, and all peoples come from that origin. So that's what I call on anarchist communities, is can we go further back, not just resist, but also create? And that was one of the formulas that we looked at too, was to create this movement. We looked at three frameworks, which is something that all people are already doing. There are creative forces out there, but we critique. So that means know our enemy, know the critiques that we need to have, and be informed. Confront. We get in their face, we blockade, we make sure that things are happening and that the industry knows that they're at fault. Confront. But we were asked by grassroots communities in our own region, because they want jobs, they want a way of life, they want to be able to sustain life for their kids. But because cumulative impacts have already destroyed at least 90% of everybody's territories, and there's only 10% of healthy territory left in every Indigenous community, pretty much, maybe some of them have very little, much less than 10%. That's what cumulative impacts has done to our populations, is we can no longer trust ourselves to go out and merely just survive off of our land. We still need the mutual aid. We still need teachings and sharing of skills to learn how to garden, harvest our garden, and to properly sustain a way of gardening. And we had thankfully a lot of help, a lot of people like Kira, and others who helped build a permaculture garden right in the camp. So that mutual aid was not only just in the form of monies and goods, but it was also in the form of skills. Trading skill for skill, we turned skills into a currency. And that was the way things were in the past. You didn't have universities and pay for university with capitalist monies to get skills. You traded skills for skills. That was a tribal way in the past too. So we're all getting back to our roots here. The difference is that many anarchist communities are from settler nations and are here, and there's an attempt and opportunity to deny colonial state, yes, but can anarchist communities acknowledge that there is a law of the land wherever we're at? It's not a law that is controlling or telling you how to live. It's a law that says if you want this to be an abundance for your future generations, this is the natural law of the world. And it's nature that provided Indigenous peoples with our laws. We didn't make these laws. We observed nature for thousands of years. We made a lot of mistakes within those thousands of years. And that's why we have trickster stories. Because tricksters are not some entity that was like Yeshua or Santa Claus or anything. The trickster was us. We made all those mistakes. We made our blunders and transformed our world. But it also provided us with our laws. So most of our intense laws are actually in our trickster legends. The trickster legends teach us about our own mistakes, that we are our own worst enemy. We could effectively destroy this planet if we had to, if we wanted to, but we don't. So the trickster legends and the natural laws are the law of the land. And we even abide by these laws. And that's by, in the form of self-regulating these laws. We self-regulate our laws. And yes, we had warriors in our history, but they weren't following people around, making sure they're living by their laws. It was just expected of us. We weren't afraid of the warriors. We were proud of them and we supported them. And they didn't control us. If we needed correction, we weren't sent off to some building far away and protected from the elements and controlled. What happened was maybe an elder might say, look at how Mel is acting in the feast hall. We should go talk to his parents. They missed teaching him this virtue or this ideology. They missed it. They didn't come and challenge me and correct me and shame me. They nurtured my parents so they would teach me what I missed. That was our way of correction, so that we would live by our natural laws. It was a gentle process that did not, we didn't have to grow up with shame and build on shame. And we see that in nation states with prisons and with jail systems and policing. Because we know the origin of police. It wasn't to protect people, it was to chase you off to work with their billy club and to suppress unions so that the bosses could keep the workplace unsafe. Well, thank goodness the unions formed and we always say fuck the police. So because we want to live, we want to provide to our kids, we want to do this safely. And so that's what I ask is, can anarchist communities support local indigenous movements to build themselves up and get that mutual aid going and find an understanding of how anarchy movements can live by the natural laws without thinking that we have to take on some controls. We don't have to feel controls. Decolonization is a painful process. Indigenous movements are not perfect. In real life, we're quite goofy, we're fun, we make mistakes, we do our best, we put our best foot forward. We do make a lot of strong moves. We also make mistakes. It's the colonized mind. We learned doubt, we learned disbelief and shame and guilt. That's what we're breaking free from. So if anarchist communities can support indigenous movements, we ask of that understanding that we're all in the same position. We're all just the same. We're goofy and clumsy and funny and really good people. And we all put our best foot forward. That's the commonality I see between indigenous movements and anarchist movements.
This week's episode features a workshop by Mel Basil, an indigenous Gitxan and Wet'suwet'en organizer, sovereigntist, and anarchist of the Unist'ot'en Action Camp. For folks in the listening audience, Unist'ot'en is located on unceded native lands in so-called British Columbia, Canada. More about the Unist'ot'en Action Camp can be found at unistotencamp.com. Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bruce Sugunis. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF out of Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can contact us for ideas and criticisms and whatever else at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. I don't want to think about it, I just want to get down. Get down. Get down. Get down.